check in, but they've checked out too, and they're across the hall or listen to. There's something about a stadium going on in another room right now where committee members are. So as exciting as this is, unless we're going to do the Racino bill again today, we probably won't get a whole lot of people from that committee down here. Anyway, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. I'm Rob Schonsberg. I'm here representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. We have limited resources in the ethanol industry, so I'm also a senior vice president with POET, and I'm also a board member for Growth Energy. What we've got this morning, before I get started, thank you for having us. Thanks for taking the time. I know that you're wrapping up and you've got busy agenda, so thanks for taking the time. What I put together for you, and I apologize for the small font. I'll have a hard time reading it myself. Really, what I tried to do with the presentation, and I can provide you with hard copies as well, is give you kind of a national 40,000-foot perspective of what's going on with the industry from a policy and economic standpoint, and then kind of explain how that has a trickle-down effect not only to Minnesota but really to the entire country. But there are some pretty big state ramifications with these policy discussions that are going on with at the federal level. I'm focusing particularly on RFS2, which is the energy bill that passed in 2007. Number one. Number two is the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit that expires this year, the import tariff that also expires this year, and to me, the biggest issue that we face as domestic ethanol producers is market access. That's probably singularly the biggest issue that we're challenged with, and that's a big reason why you're seeing some of, in my opinion, some of the assaults on the industry. It's also one of the reasons that you're seeing some of the economic challenges that you're seeing within the industry. So it all comes down to market access from my standpoint, and long term, if we really, really want to address what's going on with this industry, we've got to figure out how to provide much, much greater market access than what we have today. This is a very, very busy slide, and it's busy because it highlights some of the things that we actually were successful in pushing forward in 2009. This is probably 99% relative to what's going on in the federal government, in the Congress. As I said, I'm wholeheartedly a market access guy. I think that if ethanol were given the opportunity to compete in a more open, level playing field, we could do exactly that. And so my focus from a policy standpoint at the federal level is how many different types of demand-side opportunities can we open up for this domestic industry? Growth Energy, and I played a fairly significant role in that, although all of the smart stuff we had to consult with people from Minnesota to help us get done. So we did, as Growth Energy, submit the waiver request to the EPA for E15. I'm confident in the report. I'm confident in the data. I can tell you with complete certainty that we haven't moved the needle on this baseline fuel for 30 years. So this is not an easy pull. If it were easy, it would have been done 5 or 10 or 25 years ago. But I can tell you that we submitted more data to support a petition for E15 than has been required in the history of the EPA review process. I'm fully confident in our ability to hit E15. I think that it's going to happen. We're dealing with some secondary issues with the waiver request, such as bifurcation, and there's been recent talk about what that means in the industry. What bifurcation from an EPA standpoint means is that EPA, because of the data that was submitted, is going to choose, we believe, 2001 and newer vehicles, which creates a bit of an issue here in Minnesota since you have a mandate in place. But we're working through those issues both at the state and at the national level. ASTM, Underwriters Laboratories, authorities having jurisdiction, OSHA, health effects testing is going to cost us nearly $400,000 to complete, but those are all the types of things that we are taking upon ourselves to get in place, hopefully to coincide with an affirmative response from the EPA. And all of that has to be done before E15 can be introduced into commerce. So it's a lot of it's a lot of work being done behind the scenes to make sure that we're prepared to offer E15 into commerce.
Are you going to be talking more about that, or is this your only waiver slide?
I can talk about it as much as you would like,
sir. My question is, you said it'll affect Minnesota because we have a mandate. My assumption is if the EPA comes out in August or whenever they do and they have a partial waiver, not a full waiver, so it is, say, 2001 or newer, I think that's a poison pill for E15 across the country, not just Minnesota, because a retailer would have to manage a couple different pumps, and why would you put in a separate pump at all?
Well, whether or not, from an infrastructure standpoint, they have to put in a separate pump is maybe a little bit debatable. I can see the day when E10 becomes maybe your premium fuel and E15 becomes your regular fuel. If that be the case, you wouldn't have to necessarily put in new pumps. That's one of the reasons we're working with Underwriters Laboratories or the authority having jurisdiction to get those certification pieces worked out. But at the end of the day, E15 is not a mandate. We're not requiring that it be introduced or sold to consumers. What I wholeheartedly believe, and I will get into this a little bit deeper later on in the presentation, if ethanol is allowed to compete in the marketplace, economics are going to drive E15. Because if I can offer to you E15 for X cents less than E10, or E0, consumers are going to push the product. So it, just like E10, since it took us 30 years to push it out into the marketplace, and we're at about 88% market saturation today, with the exception of, there are very few places like Minnesota where we have this kind of market access. But
again, with the waiver, it's going to be hard for anyone to push that number to E15. I mean, you can go into the refineries in Minnesota today or last winter or whenever and ask them if we didn't have the mandate in Minnesota where they'd be blending, and they will freely admit they'd be blending at 10%. Why?
Right.
Because of what you just said, economics. They're making more money,
right,
blending as much ethanol as they can into the product. So they get that. But when you go to E15 with the waiver, I think it's difficult across the country to manage it, that.
There's no question, Mr. Chairman, that it's going to take time for us to work out those market tweaks. I can tell you from a competitive standpoint, I think it's largely going to come down to whether or not we can talk to retailers about the advantages of offering greater percentage of ethanol. And at the end of the day, it's going to come down to money. If we can deliver a better product to consumers, which I believe it will be and prove to be, and it's more affordable from an economic standpoint, we're going to figure it out.
Second question, as you know, we're going to be applying CRI this year through our own Department of Agriculture and ethanol producers cooperating for an E20 mandate. You just said the E15 took more... was required more information than you've ever seen before on anything out there. What's that mean for our E20 request?
We have been working with officials in the Department of Ag, the governor's office. We've had these discussions ourselves. We've let the state of Minnesota know that whatever data that we have available or either we commissioned to be done or we collected through the process or the consultants that we used, whether they be former auto employees or auto information or environmental consultants, we would readily make that information available. I think having been up to my nose in E15 for the last 18 months, I can tell you that if we don't have more data than what we submitted today, we're going to have a challenge getting E20 approved. That's on the challenge side. The opportunity side is that the Department of Energy is wrapping up studies on higher blends of ethanol, E20, for example. Those should be wrapped up by mid-year, the end of the year, first quarter 2011. Once we have that conclusive evidence, E20 becomes undeniable. Frankly, it becomes a matter of timing and right, when you submit it.
I guess that was part of my questioning, too, is they have all this data. A lot of the data they collected was not specific to E15. I'm thinking about testimony they had from even other countries, Brazil and other
right,
people that came in that talked about their grades, which are much higher than
right,
ours, and running the same vehicles and other things. So they have data above E15.
Right.
Are we able to piggyback on that data reference it in other things in our submission.
Yeah, and the last thing I would add on, Mr. Chairman, is I would say that in addition to being able to add on to the data and try to hit the litmus test that EPA has, you also need to consider from a legal survival standpoint, how much data do you need? It's kind of like collecting petition signatures. You probably want a few extras. So that's a real threat to us as well. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, if you got any other questions on E15, I'd be glad to continue. Moving on.
We'll interrupt, Joe.
Yes, sir. Okay. The VTEC and the tariff both expire this year. You're going to hear information later this morning where you all are going to see that you have an extreme vested interest in the tariff and the VTEC. The tax credit is also included in legislation we have on both the House and the Senate side, where we're extending all three for a period of 5 years. To be honest with you, it's going to be a heavy, heavy lift, and it's going to take a lot of people to get that done. If there's one thing that I could suggest is, from a state standpoint, members of Congress need to hear from us at the state level. There's a lot of people working against these types of initiatives, and without support and without help, it's going to be awfully tough to get it done. At the same time, we have legislation established for country of origin labeling on fuel. This has certainly gotten some attention since the introduction. The Open Fuel Standard on the House side, the Choice Act on the Senate side, both mandate flex fuel vehicle production. Basically, what we're talking about is codifying the domestic industry's voluntary schedule that they've already committed to, but we'd like the foreign auto companies to participate as well. Blender pumps, tax credits, and a dedicated ethanol pipeline. Those are the other demand-side types of legislation that we're pursuing in the Congress.
Who's working with the tax credits for blender pumps? Obviously, that goes back to your E15. That's one of the solutions, is if we had blender pumps in every station in this land, you could have any grade and multiple grades for anything you want.
Yes, sir. If I were to jump to the conclusion, I would tell you that we're kind of playing around the edges of solving the problem. And blender pumps and flex fuel vehicles and pipelines to New York Harbor, those are the types of things that we need to accomplish. As far as the legislation itself, Congresswoman Stephanie Hirsa Sandlin and Congressman John Shimkus introduced legislation to take the E85 tax credit legislation or current language and extend that to blender pumps. I'm of the opinion that you probably don't need to offer a $50,000 tax credit for these pumps. I think if you offered a $25,000 refundable tax credit, you would provide enough incentive for the retailers to install blender pumps. And what you're doing then is you jump over a lot of these hurdles that you had previously mentioned with E15, for example. If you give consumers a choice to pick the fuel that they want, and they're driving automobiles that can handle E0 to E85, let the people pick. So that all kind of fits into the master chaotic plan that we have here, and what I'm actually showing you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schomburg, is someone going to talk to us about the dedicated pipelines and how that? What's the state of the land here? Lay the land on those. What do you need? What do you folks think needs to be done, and where are we at, and what do we want to get to?
Yes, sir. Mr. Yep. Chairman, we have legislation introduced. Iowa members of Congress are primarily sponsoring it. We're not asking for new money. We're not asking for grants. What we're asking for is loan guarantee ability from an existing program within the Department of Energy. So it's an existing program that we would use to construct the pipeline. And POET, this is a company-specific thing, but POET is partnered with Magellan, one of our friends on the distribution side, to construct. We're in the phase of from a feasibility standpoint. But this is a massive, massive project. When you're talking about ending terminals, bookends that start in Mitchell, South Dakota, and end in New York Harbor, you're talking billions of dollars in new capital cost. So it's not cheap. But long term, we got to figure out how to get to where the people live. So we need to go east, we need to go west, and pipelines are one of the ways in which we can do that at a very, very large scale. It's going to take some time, but at the same time, it's going to create thousands and thousands of jobs between South Dakota and New York Harbor. So what we need is support from the state standpoint for our ability to push this legislation through the Congress. So I'd be happy to give you details on sponsors and language and the like at your leisure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schomsberg, have they, you know, I understand in the past there's been some issues in trying to pipeline ethanol. Is that, have those been worked out? Or have we got the technology available now that we can actually pipeline it?
Yes, sir. Two responses to maybe the question or the point. Number one, we're talking about a dedicated ethanol pipeline, so we're not talking about switching out different products. This is a dedicated ethanol pipeline, so regardless, there is no issue because you're not swapping out different products. Number two, from what I understand, I think there was an issue in Florida at one point with a pipeline, and to my knowledge, it's been alleviated, and so I think we were able to figure out those dynamics, but you know, at the end of the day, when you're talking about a dedicated ethanol pipeline, largely that issue goes away.
Just a follow-up to that, I'm asked this not knowing the answer, and I've asked it before, and I haven't gotten the answer. Have you worked at all? We have a seaport called Duluth Superior in our area, and you are shipping to seaports on the East Coast. You're talking about doing it with pipelines, you're doing it with rail now. Mm-hmm. Have we explored with that authority up in Duluth utilizing ocean-going vessels out of Duluth to move that product in ocean tankers, or you know, the ones that will fit through the locks, to go that route? I've asked actually the folks in Duluth, and they had never had that question asked to them or even explored it. Mm. I guess I'm wondering if Minnesota Ethanol is thinking, you know, it'd be a lot easier to run pipes up to Duluth through Minnesota from Iowa and, you know, the upper Midwest and head out that way for 8 months of the year. Have anyone done anything on the cost of that, the feasibility of that, utilization of that?
It sounds like a worthy inquiry. I mean, the honest answer is
no.
The answer is no to all of the above. Right. Yeah,
that's the idea that came from the House Ag Committee. We hope you'll take us up on maybe just, you know, I'd like to see that question asked. Again, Duluth, it was interesting because the Port Authority up there said, you know what, no one's ever asked us about shipping liquid fuels out of here to the East Coast, and a comparison on rail costs now versus the larger and probably cheaper way to go through the waters.
I would commit to you that review. I mean, we've got the smartest logistics and transport people probably on the planet, so I would gladly follow up on that.
And if you're, the billions of dollars you spend on Ovistar wants to fix the locks up there and make sure we can get bigger ships, if that would happen, it'd really be something. Nope, you're good? All right.
So just rounding out the second slide, big picture, really the biggest fights are at the federal level and over market space, and this is not news to you, but in some of the states I think it brings them comfort to know that pretty much every state in the union, notably all of the corn producing states in the union, are all under pretty heavy financial strain. Outstanding items, quickly, 2010 is going to be a big year from a market standpoint, from an environmental standpoint. RFS2, all of the producers in Minnesota and across the country need to be re-registered with EPA in order to generate RIN credits. The endangerment finding is not a product necessarily of, if you're familiar with it or not, the highlight or the low light with the endangerment finding is that basically, the Supreme Court told us that the EPA indeed has the right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and then the endangerment finding is what followed as a product of the EPA. But this is the thing that is going to apply that will continue to apply a lot of pressure to ethanol producers, and I would submit probably anyone doing business from a stationary source standpoint. So it's something that you all need to be familiar with. And I would say that what we need from state governments is the ability to work with you, because the hammer's already coming from EPA. So if we've got outlets or inlets through MPCA or through other state organizations or associations, I can see that train coming down the tracks. The California Air Resources Board effectively adopted language that outlaws Midwest corn ethanol. Growth Energy filed suit against CARB. We've got a pretty big hearing coming up on that next month. That's a big market for us, and there are 10 to 15 states that if we lose in California, all of the Midwest loses, because there will be 10 to 15 states that follow suit. It's
so
a big, big deal.
Piecing that, what you just said, together with what I saw on the previous slide with the cellulosic tax credit, is California then on our side working with the cellulosic tax credit so that we can have our plants producing more cellulosic ethanol for their market? Are they on board then getting that going in Congress, since they don't want corn ethanol from us?
You know, frankly, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what California wants.
Maybe I was being facetious.
Continuing on, I'm going to talk to you about a little bit more about indirect land use change. We've had that discussion in Minnesota a couple of different times. We're certainly having it in the Congress. I'm going to talk to you about the discrimination clause. That's my word. That's my description for something that took place in the RFS2. The 15 billion gallon cap within the RFS2. Basically, corn ethanol producers get to participate in the first 15 billion gallons. That's a problem, because our capacity is pushing 14 plus right now. So if you combine a 15 billion gallon cap with yield improvements that are going through the roof over the next 15 to 20 years, what you've got is the recipe for the next farm crisis. You can't arbitrarily suppress demand and not have an impact on the greater society. And that's kind of what's happening here with RFS2 and this cap on corn ethanol. To make RFS2 a little bit more agitating, at least from my standpoint, the only advanced biofuel that was approved in this U.S. passed law was Brazilian sugarcane ethanol. Brazil cane ethanol is the only fuel that qualifies as an advanced biofuel. Even the sorghum guys are sort of scratching their head wondering why they don't qualify. This is really peculiar what took place here. Repowering grants, minimum octane standards, loan guarantees, those are all things that we're working on, to your point, Mr. Chairman, about advanced and cellulosic. Here's something that's brand new for the corn ethanol industry. We've never seen government-mandated competition from a feedstock standpoint before. We've never seen it. Advanced and cellulosic ethanol or feedstocks can fully displace the first 15 billion gallons. So technically speaking, Brazil or cellulosic ethanol made out of municipal solid waste, if you produced it in mass, it could take out the first 15 billion gallons, which displaces all of your corn ethanol production. That's technically what could happen with an RFS2. Political instability with the VTEC and the tariff and the lack of market access are all kind of adding to the kind of the financial chaos that we've got here in the market. And I promised you that this is going to get better, because I think I've got a solution for this. I get almost depressed when I go through these slides, but there is a solution for the challenges that we face, and I think it's not only good for Minnesota, it's good for the country. So you ask yourself, what's the issue? What is this about? Why these attacks? Why the assaults? Why are all of these things coming at us all at the same time? Well, I think at the end of the day, this is my editorial comment, but this is about nothing more than money and market share. The government mandated loss for somebody who owns a monopoly, and someone who owns the market doesn't like it. I mean, it's just business is what this is, but it's money and market share at the end of the day. And oil has a 90% monopoly, and when renewable fuels are offered as alternatives and you chip away at that 90%, it creates a business friction. That's all that this is, in my opinion. Number two, ethanol is held captive in the marketplace. Government laws, for example, RFS2, which mandates 36 billion gallons of renewable fuel in this country, does not comply with what the government rules are. The government rules say you can only offer 10%. Well, 10% is 14 billion gallons. You got a mandate for 36. Your math doesn't work. So unless we come up with these multiple demand-side options, you're never going to hit the 36. So those are probably the two biggest obvious. They're kind of the gorillas in the room, but those are kind of the obvious points to me. This is simply meant to give you a perspective on what happened in 2009 from a federal lobby standpoint. Nearly $3.5 billion were spent on lobbying in 2009. You can see what happened with the healthcare industry. They spent in excess of $500 million. Clearly, the industry was under some stress. If you consider energy and natural resources in excess of $400 million, or agribusiness just over $100 million, the ethanol industry, those of us from the Midwest who do this for a living, we represent approximately 0.7% of the money spent on energy lobbying in 2009. We're barely on the radar screen. From an agribusiness standpoint, we're about 2% of what was spent on federal lobbying in 2009. So you can kind of see, if you look at the challenges that we've got and you look at the type of dollars that are being spent, it's just a math issue.
So you're not paying our lobbyists here enough money? Is that what you're telling us?
They tell me that
I don't say that on their behalf. Yes. They're all sitting here the same thing right now.
Yes.
So I'm teasing. Go ahead.
We'll take that into consideration at review time. Continuing on, this is just a snapshot of what the ethanol industry spends. Growth Energy was born a little over a year ago. Growth Energy is the largest federal lobbyist. They're still under $1 million. RFA, POET, NCGA, and ACE kind of round out the top five. So from a relative scale, you can see where we're at. Comparatively speaking, the oil and gas industry alone spent $168 million. It's a math issue. It's just math. It's just business. But this is what they invested, and we spent a couple $1 million. Other notables, you can see wind in excess of $4 million. Solar spent 1.6. If you look at a visual of how we stack up, on the left-hand side, you can see Exxon. On the right-hand side, you can see ACE, the American Coalition for Ethanol, and it kind of helps you with a visual perspective of why we're in the place that we're in, and that's what it is right there. That's what it is. This is my last, I promise, this is my last 2009 lobby slide, but I think this is really, really important, not only for state legislatures to understand, but for state governments and for people who live in Minnesota to understand. There were 187 organizations that reported lobbying on ethanol-related issues in 2009, 187 of them. 16 of them were pro-ethanol lobby groups. So, again, it's a math issue, it's a resource issue, and it's a money and market share issue. But we're not playing with small people anymore. This is a big, heavy game that we're in today, and I think it's because we're legitimately threatening to take away market share. That's what it's about. Thanks for the latitude, Mr. Chairman, on the lobby slides. Moving on to RFS2, this is not my slide. I wouldn't have the depth or intelligence to put all this stuff together. This came from EPA. And all this is meant to show you is that, indeed, corn ethanol production is capped at 15 billion gallons. You can see for yourself that in 2016, they fully intend on corn ethanol to stop growing. Keep in mind that we've got between 14.2 and 14.8 in capacity or under construction right now. So we've got a real market issue there. This is the discrimination clause. There are two ways, there are actually three ways in which the federal government capped corn ethanol producers at 15 billion gallons. Number one, they wrote it into the rule. The caps us at 15. Number two, there was I call it the discrimination clause. This is actually written in the statute. So to qualify as an advanced biofuel, you have to meet X percent greenhouse gas reduction. The problem is that, number one, the only qualifier that can participate in the advanced biofuel bucket in America is Brazil, so far. And regardless of whether or not Minnesota ethanol producers can ever get to a point where they can reduce greenhouse gas reduction by 50% compared to gasoline, they don't get to compete in the advanced bucket of the mandate because the statute specifically exempts them from doing so. That's a discrimination clause. That's not right. This is maybe one of my favorite visuals. I'm not a scientist. I haven't studied land use change. I don't know about LCA models. But what I do know is simple graphs such as these. Indirect land use change, basically, for those who don't know, basically says a corn farmer in Albert Lea, Minnesota, is directly responsible for deforestation that takes place in a foreign sovereign country. That's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. And so since I can't rationalize or work through the magic of how these numbers come about, what I can do is look at satellite imagery. And I can compare that to how the ethanol industry in this country has grown over the last couple of years. So your green line is ethanol production capacity tripling over the last few years. Your blue line, based on satellite imagery, is actually what's taking place in Brazil. The exact opposite is happening in reality compared to what the theory of indirect land use change is. That's not right. So here's the real problem, because it gets better. If we have indirect land use change in the law, and now we've promulgated rules to complement that law, there's not a single thing that prevents indirect land use charges from applying to every other sector of our economy. So residential home builders, hospitals, parking lots, schools, all of these things now come into play since it's in law and rules have been promulgated. This is a very, very dangerous thing that we've adopted in the federal government.
The other interesting point, again, I don't have the reference in front of me, but we had a hearing a year or two ago. I chair the Council of State Governments Midwest Legislative Conference Agriculture Committee. At one of those regional meetings, we had testimony on this. The other thing that Growth Energy should check out and incorporate perhaps in their slides too is, we had testimony that there's over 1 billion acres of idle agriculture cropland, productive cropland in the world right now. So to say that they're taking down trees for more agriculture land, that adds to that argument that no, they don't, and it's not, you know, Saharan desert land. It's productive land in European countries that find it more beneficial, frankly, to buy our exported corn and other products than to grow their own. And so they've idled their land at this point in time until such time as they may bring it back in. But I've heard upwards of 1 billion acres like that sitting around the world that could be brought into production for food or anything else.
And yes, sir, and that was a Stanford University study, okay. And would be happy to share it with you and whomever.
Too, I think, for people. They think there's a finite amount and that we're clearing land to grow products when there's idle acres all over this world.
Right. Well, I think I've talked to people associated with Brazil or Unica, and it's nearly a laughable situation because they've got 500 million acres of pasture land that they have to go through before they get to their trees. And frankly, tree poachers are a bigger threat in Brazil than corn ethanol production in Albert Lea, Minnesota. So it's just it's a travesty. It's a bad thing. This is another slide from. This is very telling. This is something that we all should be paying attention to. This is from RFS2. This is an EPA graph. The good news is that in this primary control case that EPA has, they assume E15 and they assume 91% market saturation. So those are two positive things from the EPA. The scary thing from this slide is that with the advent and with the proliferation of these other feedstocks, coupled with the fact that corn doesn't get to compete with those other feedstocks outside of the 15 billion gallons, EPA fully intends on other feedstocks to fully displace corn ethanol. And that's going to start, based on their graph, in 2016 or so. I should have overlaid a yield curve, because your yield curve with corn is going to look like a hockey stick. The same time that EPA assumes corn ethanol production starts to be displaced is when yields take off. That's the recipe for disaster from an agricultural standpoint that I talked about on my second slide. So RFS2 takeaways, there's absolutely no carve-out for corn. Corn simply gets to participate, and it needs to be the most competitive in order to just survive. We have no problem competing if we have more market access. But the way that it stands today, this is a real threat. Indirect land use and the discrimination clause effectively cap corn at 15 billion gallons. EPA assumes that corn-based ethanol will be fully displaced by advanced and cellulosic ethanol, and sugar-based ethanol is considered the only advanced biofuel. So this, again, kind of rounds out my impression that the only thing that hears this issue, because a crisis is not here yet, but a crisis is forthcoming, and the only thing that cures that is if we have much, much greater market access. I thought you maybe would find these of interest. This is current saturation or penetration from an ethanol standpoint. It doesn't get any better than red. Minnesota's a red state, and basically that means you're 100% saturated from an E10 standpoint. If we could take the Minnesota model and take you everywhere else, we'd be in a much, much better place. You all have done a phenomenal job here in Minnesota, and you should be commended for that. So currently we're at 88% market saturation. The odds of getting higher than that, there simply are some markets you just can't get to. This is the blend wall. People talk about the blend wall. This is it. This is it right here. Theoretically, I'm not sure that this is likely to happen or logistically able to happen, but theoretically we could see 91% E10 saturation by the end of this calendar year. I'm switching gears to the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit, and this too is an important slide. This too has a direct effect on the state of Minnesota. For the last 2.5 years, I've been in the ethanol industry. I was a public servant for 5 years prior to, and coming from a state like South Dakota, we've never had any money. We've always been broke, and so we couldn't attract businesses by offering assistance, financial assistance. So the only thing that we could do is offer, you know, we won't charge you as much in taxes, or we'll give you a refund if you build and bring your employees here. So we just didn't tap them as much from a financial standpoint. This is the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit. It's the same thing. It's a tax credit that goes to the blender of ethanol. It goes into the value chain of the fuel. So sometimes the blender gets the value, sometimes the producer gets the value. More often than not, the consumer gets the value. Everything below this red line, Mr. Chairman, is the consumer. I can show you, based on absolute certainty and economic fact, that the ultimate recipient of the tax credit is the consumer. So if the tax credit is not renewed at the end of this year or by the end of this year, effectively, since you all have an E10 mandate in Minnesota, every single gallon of fuel will go up by 4.5 cents a gallon. It's an automatic and instantaneous tax increase. There's not a single ethanol producer in the country who's getting a check or a subsidy from the federal government. That's a fallacy. So I can show you that it's the consumer who pays the price if the VTEC goes away. This is very, very important. This is a slide that I put together, and it was based on an economic evaluation that we did, Growth Energy commissioned with the University of Missouri. We simulated what the removal of the tariff would do, both from a macro standpoint and from a micro standpoint. Just the state of Minnesota, you're looking at extreme economic situations. Changes in the commodity value due to removal of the ethanol import tariff. This is just commodity value. In year three, it's nearly $1.5 billion of economic value. Total employment from a full and part-time job standpoint, year three is nearly 14,000 jobs. Total value-added impacts, more than $3 billion in the third year. So what happens is that Tom Friedman wrote a book, The World is Flat. Well, such is the case in our economy, because everything is really tied back to agriculture. So if you take an industry that's held captive to a minute portion of the liquid transportation system, and you say you can't operate outside of that, that's the very reason why the VTEC and the tariff are so important. This is pretty extreme, and I wanted to make sure that I shared this with you, because you all have a vested interest in the tariff extension. I've got copies of this study that I'd be glad to provide. It's pretty daunting.
These are Minnesota numbers, you have?
This is Minnesota specific, yes, sir. What happens is that through the course of RFS2, you never recover from this. You'll lose 13,000 jobs in the third year, and you gradually start to gain those back, but you'll never get back to baseline. We can't even begin to look at this slide, but what it basically says is across the board, it's 160,000 jobs should the tariff go away. And I can even break it down by industry. I think there's a lot of ag bankers out there who would have an interest in the tariff, for example, if they saw this report. Takeaways from the last couple of slides, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to wrap up. Clearly, the government is diversifying its portfolio. Corn ethanol producers, according to the EPA, are going to gradually become displaced by other feedstocks without the ability to compete. The market is fast approaching E10 saturation. And the only way to solve that problem from a supply standpoint and from an over-saturation standpoint, frankly, is plants need to shut down. You need to either open up the market, comply with the law, let us compete with Middle Eastern oil, or domestic plants have to shut down. Those are your options. That's it. E15 is certainly going to allow for additional growth, but it's not enough. If the federal government would comply with their own law, the day after they passed the energy bill, they would have said, E26, like Brazil, becomes the new number, and every gas station in the country is going to offer it for sale. Absent that ability, the federal government needs to figure out how to get more demand options into commerce. I can tell you, based on the VTEC slide, that we are absolutely positively competitive with gasoline. The consumer, not an ethanol subsidy, the consumer is receiving the benefit of the tax credit. The VTEC, basically, if it's removed, the federal government is increasing taxes on consumers. That's the bottom line. In a more open market, I believe that we can continue to expand our role and we can be an economical substitute for gasoline. But under current law, market access and consumer choice are the only way that we can get over some of these hurdles. I'm slowly, gradually getting into my solution that's coming. The tariff and the VTEC are critically important to Minnesota. I'd implore you to be involved and to stay involved and to help in any way that you can, and market access is the number one issue. Here's my last slide, Mr. Chairman. Our issues are not, or they're no longer confined to a single state. We are in a very, very complex environment. We're fighting over money and market share, and we need help at the federal level. That's the bottom line. Greatly expanded market opportunities. Not more government parameters or government programs. What we want is a crack at the market, a legitimate crack at the market. If we could exchange, I would venture to say that if we could poll every ethanol producer in the country and say, would you rather have a VTEC and a 15 billion gallon cap, or would you rather have a shot at 50 billion gallons worth of access? I'm pretty sure they're going to pick the 50 billion gallons worth of access. I know I would. That's where we need to go. How do we do that? Well, we do that, ladies and gentlemen, by first we got to eliminate the discrimination clause against American agriculture and corn ethanol production. That's number one. Number two, indirect land use needs to be repealed before it devastates our entire economy. We need to approve E15 soon, and we need to get it into commerce as quickly as we can and give consumers a choice. We need to get to a point where half of our vehicle fleet is flex fuel vehicles, and we're not talking, you know, we've got programs where we offer 50 or 100 blender pumps in some states. My home state, we've got a 100 blender pump program, and it's a great opportunity. It's a super start point. But it's not 100 that we need. We need 200,000. We need 4,000 in every single state so that if half of the vehicle owners pull up to a station and they can say, today I'm going to pick between E0 and E85, and we give them the choice, I'm confident that our product is going to be competitive. That's where we need to go. We need 120 million flex fuel vehicles, and we need 4,000 blender pumps in every single state. We need pipelines to the coasts, and if we create this market environment, then we're able to let all of the feedstocks compete, including corn, because if corn is the most competitive, then corn should be able to participate. That's the bottom line. And frankly, we've got about a 5-year window of opportunity. to have a serious paradigm shift in how we approach this type of policy, not in Minnesota, but in the country. And that's kind of the summary. It's about the market, Mr. Chairman.
Just one question. Going forward, Congressman Peterson is starting to hold hearings on the Farm Bill. What pieces of that, if any, are included in the energy section of his bill that he could address as opposed to the Energy Department and their dealings?
Well, there's a lot of crossover. Chairman Peterson has been a phenomenal, probably none greater asset or friend to this industry. We're constantly looking at opportunities, obviously dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. The issues have to be, you know, germane. So it's tough to talk about the types of things that have to take place on a tax standpoint within the context of the next Farm Bill, if that was your point, Mr. Chairman, but we are constantly working with the chairman and his staff to get some of these things accomplished.
Six, seven, eight, 10 things on that last slide. Go back to your last slide. So yep. Could the 200,000 blender pumps be in the Farm Bill? How much of those dashed items could be addressed within the Farm Bill that, again, as we talk to our Congress folks, and Klobuchar's on the Ag Committee and been very good with us in the Senate.
Yes, sir.
What do we have influence on, you know, with those Minnesotans as we talk to them?
In addition to Chairman Peterson, pretty much every member of the Minnesota delegation has been, they're all stars on these issues. My personal preference is, since I subscribe to the theory, we've got a five-year window of opportunity to get some things done. We can't wait till 2012. So if an energy bill moves this year, we need to try to attach ourselves. If a tax extender bill moves this year, we need to try to attach ourselves. So any and every vehicle that looks like it could move, we have no choice. We're gonna try to be there. And so we've kind of taken this all above the approach as far as these specific items are concerned. And I know that our staff and our people, particularly with Growth Energy, I can't speak for others, but they're definitely working with the Minnesota delegation.
So we should, our trip this year up St. Magnus, our ag tour should maybe be to D.C. Is that what you're thinking? We take them all out?
Might have to.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, thinking back to your previous slide showing the various colored states around the country, and I do like the color you selected for Minnesota.
You don't often see those maps, do you?
That's right. Purple is a more common color. One thing you didn't talk about was a possibility of standardizing blends or standardizing mandates on a regional or multi-state basis, and at whatever level we could accomplish. It seems to me that would make things, it would increase demand. It would make things a lot easier for our blenders and suppliers that are supplying more than one state, and I know we have that situation. Have you looked at that as one of the possibilities for increasing the viability of ethanol?
And I would just add to while you're answering, the other thing that I always assumed would help our ethanol industry is if we had a regional low-carbon fuel standard, because right now the only way to lower that carbon fuel content is by blending biofuels in. Mm-hmm. Yet, like Representative Torkelson said, you know, a third of our fuel in the state is purchased outside Minnesota's borders, and
right.
So we're dealing with Wisconsin and South Dakota and terminals elsewhere.
Yes, sir. Mandate, I'm sorry, was mandate your question, sir?
Some way of reaching standardized fuel blends on a regional basis.
You're from Poland. You're headquartered in South Dakota. You can't get your South Dakota legislature to do what Minnesota has done in putting a standard mandated grade of ethanol. And I think that's what he's asking.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Iowa, South Dakota, Wisconsin. If we were all standardized at our terminals, and it would make life a lot easier, he's saying. So how are you doing back home, is what he's asking.
Well, with a little bit more insight, I spent 5 years as the Red State Chief of Staff So I tell people in my industry today that they used to have a friend in the ethanol industry in the governor's office. Not all state legislatures are as forward-thinking and as insightful as you all. And so I can tell you that we've broached the subject. Mandates or standards are really tough to get accomplished just because you all are fiercely independent from a governance standpoint. So in an ideal world, we'd be able to create those standards. I think unless it were driven from maybe two different bookends, maybe Council of State Governments, and then maybe from a, you know, a broad industry standpoint, we'd all have to come together. Half the time, you know, we don't even get along in our own family, so it's tough to get that consensus. But that might be an opportunity to come up with a plan to pursue those types of kind of baseline standards. I think it's a great idea. Our approach so far has not been altogether successful, however.
Representative,
yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it at least to be worth taking a look at the effect of some sorts of regionalized standards and how much benefit it would be to the industry. And if that was part of your presentation, maybe folks in some of these pinkish states would start thinking about the real value to their agriculture industry of adopting a more regional approach to this whole problem.
Yes, sir.
Representative Faust. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to Representative Torkelson's question, is that there may be some other advantages in that, but as far as the terminals go, they can get whatever blend they want. They can get 91, they can get 98, they can get 90, 80, whatever they want, and all of that is programmed at the time they load the truck. 15 years ago, I was in a terminal with a trucker and watched them load and how they did that, and I was actually at Roseville. So they can do that. That isn't the issue, but there might be some marketing advantages in doing that. But as far as the terminal goes, it's not an issue.
And certainly on other issues beyond the blend grades, low carbon fuel standards is enforced at the terminal, and they all have to add something to lower their carbon fuel standard. That would be a regional issue for us that I think would be beneficial.
Mr. Chairman, on the low carbon fuel standard, I don't know if you asked for my opinion, but if I may, I might like to give it. I'm a little bit concerned about multiple low carbon fuel standards. It's because it becomes a compliance issue and it can be chaos. I've been dealing with Californians an awful lot, and it's been an interesting process. I think that we would be able to get behind, if we were involved in the process, a national low carbon fuel standard, something that as a template for the entire country. That makes more sense. I mean, it doesn't, as a non-scientist, I can understand that if you want a low-carbon economy, then you ought to use more low-carbon fuel. So it's, you know, that seems to make sense. But if we get another round of RFS2, an indirect land use change, rolled into a low-carbon fuel standard, we're even worse off. And I'm frankly turning more and more into a simple market opportunity guy. I fully believe that if we can really open this thing up, we can compete with gas. And if we've got, I'm going to keep coming back to it, if we've got 120 million flex fuel vehicles, and if we've got 4,000 blender pumps in every state, and we're saving consumers money, and we're letting American agriculture flourish, and there's demand for their product, then consumers can make the concerted effort to choose to displace 50 billion gallons of oil. Well, 50 billion gallons just happens to be what we get from the people who'd like to kill us. So it seems like we've got this great, great, great opportunity right in front of us, and it comes from the American farmer. That's where it originates. So if we just do the right thing and open up the market, we can. The American farmer and the American consumer can do more for national security than any other policy that we've probably ever seen come from the U.S. Congress.
And I appreciate that. So I'm going to add to the other leading question then that we get all the time. Yes, I think your plants can compete, yet as we drive around this state this year, last year, 10 years ago, whenever, rarely is that fuel E85 at a 20% or 15 or 20% difference where consumers are breaking even, much less a 30 or 40 or, I mean, if you're at $3 a gallon and E85 was at $2, you would have that competitive advantage, and people would be putting it in their non-E85 vehicles. Not condoning that, but they would. So how do we as a state, and that's what the consumers are asking us too, who's taking that profit? They're blaming you. And again, I'm leading you with this question, but yep, they are. They're blaming the ethanol plants. They know that the cost of that corn produced ethanol was a lot less. Or they're blaming the retailer who now says, oh, I got to wait. Or they're blaming the terminals where they're blending it that are capturing now, like you say, the blender credits and everything mm-hmm. else they have. And now they're saying, you know, we're going to price it so it's just at that 20%. It doesn't really bring anyone other than an E85 flex vehicle and make changes no one's mind. So I like the free market, but we struggle with how do we convince consumers there is a real advantage other than a retailer saying, I'm going to get people into my station for the next week by charging a buck less for E85, and then they go right back up.
Well,
who's making the money? That's what we want to know.
Well, it's not me, that's for certain. My response to that question is probably, I'd have to back up a couple of feet from the question, because I think the real issue with, maybe this would come as a surprise to some, but the real issue with E85 is we've got this, the big issue with E85, I'm not talking about Minnesota, the big issue with E85 is you've got a fraction of the vehicle fleet that are flex fuel capable. That's a problem. 7 million vehicles out of 240 are flex fuel capable, and most of those vehicles, I'm sorry, don't live next to those 2,000 stations that are in the country. There are 2,000 E85 pumps or stations in the entire country. So it's not working because there's an infrastructure issue. The second part of that issue, large scale, is that I would tell you that I'm an advocate of the product that makes the most sense for the consumer. For example, when E85 in 2008 was $1.04 less than E10, I was pumping E85 as fast as I could put it in. But today, I have the benefit of a blender pump being four blocks from where I work. And E30 happens to be 25 cents less than E10. So as a consumer, I can pick E30, save 25 cents a gallon, and I don't lose, in my personal case, I don't lose a single mile. It makes so much sense, it's almost disturbing how much sense it makes. So I would answer your question with my simple opinion that if we give people the option to choose what's best for them, whether it be E85 or E10 or, you know, OPEC, E0, I don't care. Because I know that our product can compete, because I've seen it myself.
So blender pumps is more
yes, sir.
Than E85 pumps in the short run. All right. Other questions, comments to this testifier? What else we got? Is there anyone else going to speak, or are you the...
I think I was the show, Mr. All right. Chairman.
All right. Anything else for anyone? All right, well, we do appreciate that. We'd ask you to follow up with some of that information. Get us copies, or staff can work on getting copies of this presentation out. If you could also get our office... if you could get me 134 copies of that growth energy pamphlet that goes through all those issues, food, fuel, you had some of them up here, I'd make sure every legislator in the House got one of those. It'd be nice to have some extras.
Yes, sir.
I saw your chief again at the Ag Chairs meeting, I think, this year, and
yep.
Asked him for some of that information. I haven't gotten it yet. So.
I'll deliver.
All right, that's good. Anything else before the committee? Otherwise, we do appreciate you
Thank
coming
you.
In. This is important. Certainly, ethanol is a large industry in this state, important industry, and one that we want to keep very viable. So we will keep working with you and all the plants around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. There's no more business. Oh, by the way, for all of you that have lived in a fog since we've gotten here, and most people aren't because we have this, the courts did rule against the governor, so we've got a little different budget situation now, and the stadium bill failed upstairs 10-9. So two big issues happened while you all were sitting here. We're adjourned.